He doubted that West knew exactly how he felt. The man might have been through a couple of contests before, but Giselle thought it unlikely he had been considering a surreptitious meeting with his best friend's sister the same night. He wondered whether West would be quite so considerate if he knew the contents of the letter in Giselle's breast pocket. It did not seem likely.
"We'd better get moving. Wouldn't want them to start without us."
"No." Giselle took one last deep breath, opened his eyes, and blew out hard. Then he pushed himself away from the wall and strode rapidly down the tunnel. He felt a sudden surge of panic. Where were his steals? He cast about him desperately, then breathed a long sigh. They were in his hand. There was quite a crowd in the hall at the far end. Trainers, seconds, friends, family members, and hangers-on. You could tell who the contestants were, though. The 15 young men with steels clutched tightly in their hands. The sense of fear was palpable and contagious. Everywhere Giselle looked, he saw pale, nervous faces, sweaty foreheads, anxious eyes darting around. It wasn't helped by the noise of the crowd, ominously loud beyond the closed double doors at the far end of the room, swelling and subsiding like a stormy sea. There was only one man there who didn't seem at all bothered by the occasion, leaning against the wall on his own, with one foot up on the plaster and his head tipped back, staring down his nose at the assembly through barely open eyes. Most of the contestants were lithe, stringy, athletic. He was anything but. A big, heavy man with hair shaved to dark stubble. He had a great thick neck and a doorstep of a jaw. The jaw of a commoner, Giselle rather thought, but a large and powerful commoner with a mean streak. Giselle might have taken him for someone's servant, but that he had a pair of steels dangling loosely from one hand.
"Gorst," West whispered in Giselle's ear.
"Huh, looks more like a labourer than a swordsman to me."
"Maybe, but looks can lie."
The sound of the crowd was slowly fading, and the nervy chatter within the room subsided along with it. West raised his eyebrows.
"The king's address," he whispered.
"My friends, my countrymen, my fellow citizens of the Union,"
came a ringing voice, clearly audible even through the heavy doors.
"Hoff," snorted West. "Even here he takes the king's place. Why doesn't he just put the crown on and have done with it?"
"One month ago today," came the far-off bellow of the Lord Chamberlain, "fellows of mine on the closed council put forward the question, should there be a contest this year?"
Boos and shouts of wild disapproval were heard from the crowd.
"A fair question," cried Hoff, "for we are at war, a deadly struggle in the north. The very liberties which we hold so dear, the very freedoms which make us the envy of the world, our very way of life, stand threatened by the savage."
A clerk began making his way around the room, separating the contestants from their families, their trainers, their friends.
"Good luck," said West, clapping Giselle on the shoulder. "I'll see you out there."
Giselle's mouth was dry, and he could only nod.
"And these were brave men who asked the question," boomed out Hoff's voice from beyond the doors. "Wise men, patriots all, my stalwart colleagues on the closed council. I understood why they might think there should be no contest this year."
There was a long pause.
"But I said to them, no!"
An eruption of manic cheering.
"No! No!"
screamed the crowd. Giselle was ushered into line along with the other contestants, two abreast, eight pairs. He fussed with his steels as the Lord Chamberlain droned on, though he'd checked them 20 times already.
"No, I said to them, should we allow these barbarians, these animals of the frozen north, to tread upon our way of life? Should we allow this beacon of freedom amidst the darkness of the world to be extinguished? No, I said to them, Our liberty is not for sale at any price. On this, my friends, my countrymen, my fellow citizens of the Union, on this you may depend. We will win this war.
Another great ocean swell of approval. Giselle swallowed, glanced nervously around. Bremer Dan Gorst was standing there beside him. The big bastard had the temerity to wink, grinning as if he hadn't a care in the world.
Damn idiot, whispered Giselle, but he took care that his lips didn't move.
And so, my friends, and so, came Hoff's final cries, what finer occasion could there be than when we stand upon the very brink of peril to celebrate the skill, the strength, the prowess of some of our nation's bravest sons? My fellow citizens, my countrymen of the Union, I give you your contestants! The doors were heaved open, and the roar of the crowd beyond rushed into the hall and made the rafters ring, suddenly, deafeningly loud. The front pair of swordsmen began to stride out through the bright archway, then the next pair, then the next. Giselle was sure he would freeze, motionless and staring like a rabbit. But when his turn came, his feet stepped off manfully next to Gorst's, the heels of his highly polished boots clicking across the tiled floor and through the high doorway. The square of marshals was transformed. All around, great banks of seating had been erected, stretching back and back and up on all sides, spilling over with a boiling multitude. The contestants filed down a deep valley between the towering stands towards the center of this great arena. The beams and struts and tree trunk supports like a shadowy forest on either side. Directly before them, seeming very far away, the fencing circle had been laid, a little ring of dry yellow grass in the midst of a sea of faces. Down near the front, Giselle could make out the features of the rich and noble. Dressed in their best, shading their eyes from the bright sun, on the whole, fashionably disinterested in the spectacle before them. Further back, higher up, the figures became less distinct, the clothes less fine. The vast majority of the crowd were mere blobs and specks of colour, crammed in around the distant edge of the dizzying bowl, but the commoners made up for their distance with their excitement. Cheering, shouting, standing up on their toes and waving their arms in the air. Above them, the tops of the very highest buildings around the square peered over, walls and roofs sticking up like islands in the ocean, the windows and parapets crammed with minuscule onlookers. Giselle blinked at this great display of humanity. Part of him was aware that his mouth was hanging open, but too small a part to close it. Damn, he felt queasy. He knew he should have eaten something, but it was too late now. What if he puked, right here in front of half the world? He felt that surge of blind panic again. Where did he leave his steels? Where were they? In his hand. In his hand. The crowd roared and sighed and wailed with a myriad of different voices. The contestants began to move away from the circle. Not all of them would be fighting today, most would only watch. As though there was a need for extra spectators. They began to make their way towards the front rows, but Giselle was not going with them, more was the pity. He made for the enclosures where the contestants prepared to fight. He flopped down heavily next to West, closed his eyes, and wiped his sweaty forehead as the crowd cheered on. Everything was too bright, too loud, too overpowering. Marshal Verouz was nearby, leaning over the side of the enclosure to shout in someone's ear. Giselle stared across the arena at the occupants of the royal box opposite, hoping vainly for a distraction.
His Majesty the King seems to be enjoying the proceedings, whispered West in Giselle's ear.
Hmm.
The king, in fact, appeared already to have fallen soundly asleep, his crown slipping off at an angle. Giselle wondered idly what would happen if it fell off. Crown Prince Ladislaw was there, fabulously dressed, as always, beaming around at the arena with an enormous smile, as though everyone was there for him. His younger brother, Prince Reynold, could hardly have looked more different, plain and sober, frowning worriedly at his semi-conscious father. Their mother, the Queen, sat beside them, bolt upright, with her chin in the air, studiously pretending that her august husband was wide awake, and that his crown was in no danger of dropping suddenly and painfully into her lap. Between her and Lord Hoff, Giselle's eye was caught by a young woman. Very, very beautiful. She was even more expensively dressed than Ladislaw, if that was possible, with a chain of huge diamonds round her neck, flashing bright in the sun. "Who's the woman?" asked Giselle. "Ah, the Princess Therese," murmured West. "The daughter of Grand Duke Orso, Lord of Talons. She's quite the celebrated beauty, and for once it seems that rumour doesn't exaggerate. I thought nothing good ever came from Talons." "So I've heard, but I think she might be the exception, don't you?"
Giselle was not entirely convinced. Spectacular, no doubt, but there was an icy, proud look to her eye.
"I think the Queen has it in mind that she married Prince Ladislaw."
As Giselle watched, the Crown Prince leant across his mother to favour the Princess with some witless banter, then exploded into laughter at his own joke, slapping his knee with merriment. She gave a frosty little smile, radiating contempt even at this distance. Ladislaw seemed not to notice, though, and Giselle's attention was soon distracted. A tall man in a red coat was striding ponderously towards the circle. The referee.
"It's time," murmured West.
The referee held up his arm with a theatrical flourish, two fingers extended, and turned slowly around, waiting for the hubbub to subside.
"Today, you will have the pleasure of witnessing two bouts of fencing," he thundered,
then thrust up his other hand, three fingers out, as the audience applauded.
"Each the best of three touches."
He threw up both arms.
"Four men will fight before you. Two of them will go home empty-handed."
The referee let one arm drop, shook his head sadly. The crowd sighed.
"But two will pass on to the next round."
The crowd bellowed their approval.
"Ready?"
asked Marshal Verouze, leaning forwards over Giselle's shoulder.
What a damn fool question. What if he wasn't ready? What then? Call the whole thing off? "Sorry, everyone, I'm not ready. See you next year." But all Giselle could say was,
"The time has come,"
cried the referee, turning slowly around in the centre of the arena.
"For our first bout."
"Jacket,"
snapped Verouze. Giselle fumbled with the buttons and pulled his jacket off, rolling up his shirt sleeves mechanically. He glanced sideways and saw his opponent making similar preparations. A tall, thin young man with long arms and weak, slightly dewy eyes. Hardly the most intimidating looking of adversaries. Giselle noticed his hands were trembling slightly as he took his steels from his second.
"Trained by Sepp Danvisson and hailing from Rostod in Starikland,"
the referee paused for the greatest effect,
"Curtis Danbroyer."
There was a wave of enthusiastic clapping. Giselle snorted. These clowns would clap for anyone. The tall young man got up from his seat and walked purposefully towards the circle, his steels flashing in the sunlight.
"Broyer!"
repeated the referee as the gangly idiot took his mark. West pulled Giselle's steels from their sheaths. The metallic ringing of the blades made him want to be sick again. The referee pointed once more towards the contestant's enclosure.
"And his opponent today! An officer of the King's Own, and trained by none other than Lord Marshal Verouze."
There was scattered applause, and the old soldier beamed happily.
"Hailing from Luthar in Middleland, but resident here in the Agriont. Captain Jezal Danluther!"
Another surge of cheering, far louder than Breuer had received. There was a flurry of sharp cries above the din, shouted numbers, odds being offered. Giselle felt another rush of nausea as he got slowly to his feet. "Good luck." West handed Giselle his naked steels, hilts first.
"He doesn't need luck," snapped Varouz. "This Breuer's a nobody. Just watch his reach. Press him, Giselle, press him."
It seemed to take forever to reach that ring of short, dry grass, the sound of the crowd loud in Giselle's ears, but the sound of his heart louder still, turning the grips of his steels round and round in his sweaty palms.
"Luther!"
repeated the referee, smiling wide as he watched Giselle approach. Pointless and irrelevant questions flitted in and out of his mind. Was Adi watching in the crowd, wondering whether he would come to meet her that night? Would he get killed in the war? How did they get the grass for the fencing circle into the square of marshals? He glanced up at Breuer. Was he feeling the same way? The crowd was quiet now, very quiet. The weight of the silence pressed down on Giselle as he took his mark in the circle, pushed his feet into the dry earth. Breuer shrugged his shoulders, shook his head, raised his steels. Giselle needed to piss so badly. What if he pissed himself right now? A big dark stain spreading across his trousers. The man who pissed himself at the contest. He would never live it down, not if he lived 100 years.
"Begin!"
thundered the referee. But nothing happened. The two men stood there, facing each other, steels at the ready. Giselle's eyebrow itched. He wanted to scratch it, but how? His opponent licked his lips, then took a cautious step to his left. Giselle did the same. They circled each other warily, shoes crunching gently on the dry grass, slowly, slowly drawing closer together. And as they came closer, Giselle's world contracted to the space between the points of their long steels. Now it was only a stride. Now it was a foot. Now just 6 inches separated them. Giselle's whole mind was focused on those two glittering points. 3 inches. Breuer jabbed forward weakly, and Giselle flicked it away without thinking. The blades rang gently together, and, as though that were a signal prearranged with every person in the arena, the shouting began again, scattered calls to begin with.
"Kill him, Luther!"
"Yes! Jab, jab!"
But soon dissolving once more into the rumbling, angry sea of the crowd, rising and falling with the movements in the circle. The more Giselle saw of this lanky idiot, the less daunted he became. His nerves began to subside. Breuer jabbed, clumsy, and Giselle barely had to move. Breuer cut without conviction, and Giselle parried without effort. Breuer lunged, positively inept, off balance and overextended. Giselle stepped around it and jabbed his opponent in the ribs with the blunt point of his long steel. It was all so very easy.
"One for Luther!"
cried the referee, and a surge of cheering ran around the stands. Giselle smiled to himself, basking in the appreciation of the crowd. Varouz had been right. This boob was nothing to worry about. One more touch, and he'd be through to the next round. He returned to his mark, and Breuer did the same, rubbing his ribs with one hand and staring at Giselle balefully from beneath his brows. Giselle was not intimidated. Angry looks are only any use if you can fight worth a damn.
"Begin!"
They closed quickly this time and exchanged a cut or two. Giselle could hardly believe how slowly his opponent was moving. It was as if his swords weighed a ton each. Breuer fished around in the air with his long steel, trying to use his reach to pin Giselle down. He had barely used his short steel yet, let alone coordinated the two. Worse still, he was starting to look out of breath, and they'd barely been fencing 2 minutes. Had he trained at all, this bumpkin? Or had they simply made up the numbers with some servant off the street? Giselle jumped away, danced around his opponent. Breuer flapped after him, dogged but incompetent. It was starting to become embarrassing. Nobody enjoys a mismatch, and this dunce's clumsiness was denying Giselle the opportunity to shine.
"Oh, come on!"
he shouted. A surge of laughter flowed around the stands. Breuer gritted his teeth and came on with everything he had. But it wasn't much. Giselle swatted his feeble efforts aside, dodged around them, flowed across the circle, while his witless opponent lumbered after, always three steps behind. There was no precision, no speed, no thought. A few minutes before, Giselle had been half terrified by the prospect of fencing with this gangling fool. Now he was almost bored.
"Ha!"
he cried, switching suddenly onto the attack, catching his opponent off balance with a savage cut, sending him stumbling back. The crowd came alive, roaring their support. He jabbed and jabbed again. Breuer blocked desperately, all off balance, reeled backwards, parried one last time, then tripped, his arms flailing, short steel flying out of his hand, and pitched out of the circle onto his arse. There was a wave of laughter, and Giselle could not help but join in. The poor dolt looked quite amusing, knocked on his back, with his legs in the air like some sort of turtle.
"Captain Luther wins!" roared the referee. 2-0!
The laughter turned to jeering as Breuer rolled over. He looked on the verge of tears, the oaf. Giselle stepped forwards and offered his hand, but found himself unable to entirely wipe the smirk off his face. His beaten adversary pointedly ignored his help, pushing himself up from the ground and giving him a look half-hating, half-hurt. Giselle shrugged pleasantly. "It's not my fault, you're shit."
"More?"
asked Casper, holding out the bottle in a wobbly hand, eyes misted over with too much booze.
"No, thanks."
Giselle pushed the bottle gently away before Casper had the chance to pour. He looked blearily bewildered for a moment, then he turned to Jalenhorm.
"More?"
"Always."
The big man slid his glass across the rough tabletop in a way that said, "I am not drunk," though he clearly was. Casper lowered the bottle towards it, squinting at the glass as though it was a great distance away. Giselle watched the neck of the bottle wobbling in the air, then rattling on the edge of the glass. The inevitability of it was almost painful to behold. Wine spilled out across the table, splashing into Jalenhorm's lap.
"You're drunk!"
complained the big man, staggering to his feet and brushing at himself with big drunken hands, knocking his stool over in the process. A few of the other patrons eyed their table with evident disdain.
"Always!"
giggled Casper. West looked up briefly from his glass. "You're both drunk."
"Not our fault!"
Jalenhorm groped for his stool.
"It's him!"
He pointed an unsteady finger at Giselle.
"He won,"
gurgled Casper.
"You won, didn't you? And now we gotta celebrate."
Giselle wished they didn't have to celebrate quite so much. It was becoming embarrassing.
"My cousin Aris were there. Saw the whole thing. She was very impressed."
Casper flung his arm round Giselle's shoulder.
"Think she's quite schmitten with you. Schmitten. Mitten."
He worked his wet lips in Giselle's face, trying to get his mouth round the word.
"She's very rich, you know. Very rich indeed. Schmitten."
Giselle wrinkled his nose. He had not the slightest interest in that ghostly simpleton of a cousin, however rich she was, and Casper's breath stank.
"Good. Lovely."
He disentangled himself from the lieutenant and shoved him away none too gently.
"So, when are we starting on this business in the north?"
demanded Brint, a little too loud, as though he for one couldn't wait to get underway.
"Soon, I hope. Home before winter, eh, Major?"
snorted West, frowning to himself. "We'll be lucky to have left before winter the rate we're going." Brint looked a little taken aback.
"Well, I'm sure we'll give these savages a thrashing whenever we get there." "Give them a thrashing!"
cried Casper.
Aye.
Jallanhorm nodded his agreement. West was not in the mood. I wouldn't be too sure about that. Have you seen the state of some of these levies? They can hardly walk, let alone fight. It's a disgrace. Jallanhorm dismissed all this with an angry wave of his hand.
They are nothing but fucking savages, a lot of them. We'll knock them on their asses, like Giselle did that idiot today. Eh, Giselle? Home before winter? Everyone says so.
Do you know the land up there? Asked West, leaning across the table. Forests, mountains, rivers, on and on. Precious little open space to fight in, precious few roads to march on. You've got to catch a man before the thrashing can start. Home before winter. Next winter, maybe, if we come back at all. Brint's eyes were wide open and horrified. You can't mean that. No, no, you're right. West sighed and shook himself. I'm sure it'll all turn out fine. Glory and promotions all round. Home before winter. I'd take a coat with you, though, just in case. An uneasy silence descended on the group. West had that hard frown on his face that he got sometimes, the frown that said they'd get no more fun out of him tonight. Brint and Jallanhorm looked puzzled and surly. Only Casper maintained his good humour, and he was lolling back in his chair, eyes half closed, blissfully unaware of his surroundings. Some celebration. Giselle himself felt tired, annoyed, and worried. Worried about the contest, worried about the war, worried about Ardy. The letter was still there, folded up in his pocket. He glanced sidelong at West, then quickly away. Damn, he felt guilty. He had never really felt guilty before, and he didn't like it one bit. If he didn't meet her, he would feel guilty for leaving her on her own. If he did, he'd feel guilty for breaking his word to West. It was a dilemma, all right. Giselle chewed at his thumbnail. What the hell was it about this damn family?
Well, said West sharply, I have to be going. Early start tomorrow.
Muttered Brint.
Right,
said Jallanhorm. West looked Giselle right in the eye.
Can I have a word?
His expression was serious, grave, angry even. Giselle's heart lurched. What if West had found out about the letter? What if Ardy had told him? The Major turned away, moved over towards a quiet corner. Giselle stared around, desperately seeking for some way out.
Giselle,
called West.
Yes, yes.
He got up with the greatest reluctance and followed his friend, flashing what he hoped was an innocent-seeming smile. Perhaps it was something else, nothing to do with Ardy. Please let it be something else.
I don't want anyone else to know about this.
West looked round to make sure no one was watching. Giselle swallowed. Any moment now he would get a punch in the face. At least one. He had never been punched in the face, not properly. A girl slapped him pretty hard once, but that was hardly the same. He prepared himself as best he could, gritting his teeth, wincing slightly.
Burr has set a date. We've got 4 weeks.
Giselle stared back.
What? Until we embark.
Embark? For Angland, Giselle?
Oh, yes. Angland, of course. 4 weeks, you say? I thought you ought to know, since you're busy with the contest, so you'd have time to get ready.
Keep it yourself, though.
Yes, of course.
Giselle wiped his sweaty forehead.
You're all right. You look pale. I'm fine, fine.
He took a deep breath.
All this excitement, you know, the fencing and everything.
Don't worry. You did well today. West clapped him on the shoulder. But there's a lot more to do. 3 more bouts before you can call yourself a champion, and they'll only get harder.
Don't get lazy, Giselle, and don't get too drunk,
he threw over his shoulder as he made for the door. Giselle breathed a long sigh of relief as he returned to the table where the others were sitting. His nose was still intact. Brint had already started to complain. Now he could see that West wasn't coming back.
What the hell was all that?
He asked, frowning and jabbing his thumb at the door.
I mean to say, well, I know he's supposed to be the big hero and all of that, but, well, I mean to say.
Giselle stared down at him.
What do you mean to say?
Oh, to talk that way. It's defeatist. The drink was lending him courage now, and he was warming to his topic.
It's, well, I mean to say, it's cowardly talk is what it is.
Now look here, Brint, snapped Giselle. He fought in 3 pitched battles, and he was first through the breach at Ulrioch. He may not be a nobleman, but he's a damn courageous fellow. Added to that, he knows soldiering, he knows Marshal Burr, and he knows Angland. What do you know, Brint?
Giselle curled his lip.
Except how to lose at cards and empty a wine bottle.
That's all a man needs to know in my book,
laughed Jallanhorm nervously, doing his best to calm the situation.
More wine!
He bellowed at no one in particular. Giselle dropped down on his stool. If the company had been subdued before West left, it was even more so now. Brint was sulking. Jallanhorm was swaying on his stool. Casper had fallen soundly asleep, sprawled out on the wet tabletop, his breathing making quiet slurping sounds. Giselle drained his wine glass and stared round at the unpromising faces. Damn, he was bored. It was a fact, he was only now beginning to realize, that the conversation of the drunk is only interesting to the drunk. A few glasses of wine can be the difference between finding a man an hilarious companion or an insufferable moron. He wondered if he himself was as tedious drunk as Casper or Jallanhorm or Brint. Giselle gave a thin smile as he looked over at the sulking bastard. If he were king, he mused, he would punish poor conversation with death, or at least a lengthy prison term. He stood up from his chair. Jallanhorm stared up at him.
What are you doing?
Better get some rest, snapped Giselle. Need to train tomorrow.
It was the most he could do not to just run out of the place.
But you won! Ain't you going to celebrate?
First round. I've still 3 more men to beat, and they'll all be better than that oaf today.
Giselle took his coat from the back of the chair and pulled it over his shoulders.
Suit self,
said Jallanhorm, then slurped noisily from his glass. Casper raised his head from the table for a moment, hair on one side plastered to his skull with spilled wine.
Conversation?
Said Giselle, as he turned and stalked out. There was a cold wind blowing in the street outside. It made him feel even more sober than before, painfully sober. He badly needed some intelligent company, but where could he find it at this time of night? There was only one place he could think of. He slipped the letter out of his pocket and read it in the dim light from the tavern's windows just one more time. If he hurried, he might still catch her. He began to walk slowly towards the Four Corners. Just to talk, that was all. He needed someone to talk to. No. He forced himself to stop. Could he truly pretend that he wanted to be her friend? A friendship between a man and a woman was what you called it when one had been pursuing the other for a long time and had never got anywhere. He had no interest in that arrangement. What then? Marriage? To a girl with no blood and no money? Unthinkable. He imagined bringing Ardy home to meet his family. Here is my new wife, father. Wife? And her connections are? He shuddered at the thought. But what if they could find something in between, where everyone would be comfortable? His feet began slowly to move. Not friendship, not marriage, but some looser arrangement. He strode down the road towards the Four Corners. They could meet discreetly and talk and laugh, somewhere with a bed, maybe.
No, no.
Giselle stopped again and slapped the side of his head in frustration. He couldn't let that happen, even supposing she would. West was one thing, but what if other people found out? It wouldn't hurt his reputation any, of course, but hers would be ruined. Ruined! His flesh crept at the thought. She didn't deserve that, surely. It wasn't good enough to say it was her problem. Not good enough. Just so he could have a little fun. the selfishness of it. He was amazed that it had never occurred to him before. So he had reasoned himself into a corner then, just as he had done 10 times already today. Nothing good could come from seeing her. They would be away to war soon anyway, and that would put an end to his ridiculous pining. Home to bed, then, and train all day tomorrow. Train and train until Marshal Verrouz had battered her out of his thoughts. He took a deep breath, squared his shoulders, turned, and set off towards the Agrient. The statue of Herod the Great loomed out of the darkness on a marble plinth almost as tall as Giselle, seeming far too big and grand for its quiet little square near the four corners. He had been jumping at shadows all the way here, avoiding people, doing his best to be inconspicuous. There weren't many people around, though. It was late, and most likely Ardy would have given up waiting a long time ago, provided she was even there to begin with. He crept nervously around the statue, peering into the shadows, feeling an absolute fool. He had walked through this square many times before and never given it a second thought. Was it not a public space, after all? He had as much right as anyone to be here. But somehow he still felt like a thief. The square was empty. That was a good thing. All for the best. There was nothing to gain, everything to lose, and so forth. So why did he feel so completely crushed? He stared up at Herod's face, locked into that stony frown that sculptors reserve for the truly great. He had a fine, strong jaw, did Herod, almost the equal of Giselle's own.
"Wake up!"
hissed a voice by his ear. Giselle let vent to a girlish squeal, scrambled away, tripped, only stayed upright by clawing at King Herod's enormous foot. There was a dark figure behind him, a hooded figure. Laughter.
"No need to piss yourself."
Ardy. She pushed back her hood. Light from a window slanted across the bottom part of her face, catching her lopsided smile.
"It's only me."
"I didn't see you,"
he mumbled pointlessly, quickly releasing his desperate grip on the huge stone foot and doing his best to appear at ease. He had to admit it was a poor start. He had no talent for this cloak-and-dagger business. Ardy seemed quite comfortable, though. It made him wonder whether she hadn't done it all before.
"You've been pretty hard to see yourself lately," she said.
"Well,
he muttered, heart still thumping from the shock. "I've been busy, what with the contest and all."
"Ah, the all-important contest. I saw you fight today."
"You did?"
"Very impressive."
"Oh, thank you.
My brother said something, didn't he?"
"What, about fencing?"
"No, numbskull. About me."
Giselle paused, trying to work out the best way to answer that one.
"Well, he..."
"Are you scared of him?"
"No."
Silence.
"All right, yes."
"But you came anyway.
I suppose I should be flattered."
She walked slowly around him, looking him up and down, from feet to forehead and back again.
"You took your time, though. It's late. I'll have to be getting home soon."
There was something about the way she was looking at him which was not helping to calm his thumping heart. Quite the opposite. He had to tell her that he could not see her any more. It was the wrong thing to do, for both of them. Nothing good could come from it.
Nothing good.
He was breathing quick, tense, excited, unable to take his eyes away from her shadowy face. He had to tell her now. Wasn't that why he came? He opened his mouth to speak, but the arguments all seemed a long way away now, applying at a different time and to different people, intangible and weightless.
"Ardy," he began.
"Mm-hmm."
She stepped towards him, head cocked on one side. Giselle tried to move away, but the statue was at his back. She came closer still, lips slightly parted, her eyes fixed on his mouth.
"What was so wrong in it, anyway?"
Closer still, her face turned up towards his. He could smell her.
His head was full of the scent of her. He could feel her warm breath on his cheek. What could be wrong with this? Her fingertips were cold against his skin, brushing the side of his face, tracing the line of his jaw, curling through his hair, and pulling his head down towards her. Her lips touched his cheek, soft and warm, then his chin, then his mouth. They sucked gently at his. She pressed herself up against him, her other hand slipped round his back. Her tongue lapped at his gums, at his teeth, at his tongue, and she made little sounds in her throat. So did he, perhaps. He really wasn't sure. His whole body was tingling, hot and cold at once. His mind was in his mouth. It was as if he'd never kissed a girl before. What could be wrong with this? Her teeth nipped at his lips, almost painful, but not quite. He opened his eyes, breathless, trembling, weak at the knees. She was looking up at him. He could see her eyes gleaming in the darkness, watching him carefully, studying him. Adi.
What?
When can I see you again? His throat was dry, his voice sounded hoarse. She looked down at the ground with a little smile, a cruel smile, as though she'd called his bluff and won a pile of money from him. He didn't care. When?
Oh, I'll let you know.
He had to kiss her again. Shit on the consequences. Fuck West. Damn it all. He bent down towards her, closed his eyes.
No, no, no.
She pushed his mouth away from hers. You should have come sooner. She broke away from him and turned around, with the smile still on her lips, and walked slowly away. He watched her, silent, frozen, fascinated, his back against the cold stone base of the statue. He had never felt like this before, not ever. She glanced back just once, as if to check that he was still watching. His chest constricted, almost painfully, just to see her look at him. Then she rounded a corner and was gone. He stood there for a moment, his eyes wide open, just breathing. Then a cold gust of wind blew through the square, and the world pressed back in upon him. Fencing, the war, his friend West, his obligations. One kiss, that was all. One kiss, and his resolve had leaked away like piss from a broken chamber pot. He stared around, suddenly guilty, confused and scared. What had he done here?
Shit,
he said. Chapter 30. Dark Work. A burning thing can make all kinds of smells. A live tree, fresh and sappy, smells different ablaze to a dead one, dry and withered. A pig alight and a man smell much the same, but there's another story. This burning that the dogman smelled now, that was a house. He knew it, sure as sure. A smell he knew better than he'd have liked. Houses don't burn on their own too often. Usually there's some violence in it. That meant men around, most likely, and ready for a fight. So he crept right careful down between the trees, slid on his belly to the edge, and peered out through the brush. He saw it now right enough. Black smoke in a tall pillar, rising up from a spot down near the river. A small house, still smoking, but burned down to the low stone walls. There'd been a barn, too, but nothing more now than a pile of black sticks and black dirt. A couple of trees and a patch of tilled earth. It was a poor enough living at the best of times, farming this far north. Too cold to grow much, a few roots maybe, and some sheep to herd. A pig or two, if you were lucky. Dogman shook his head. Who'd want to burn out folks as poor as this? Who'd want to steal this stubborn patch of land? Some men just like to burn, he reckoned. He eased out a touch further, looking right and left down the valley for some sign of the ones as did this, but a few stringy sheep spread out across the valley sides was all he could see moving. He wriggled back into the brush. His heart sank as he sneaked back towards the camp.
voices raised and arguing as ever. He wondered for a minute whether to just go past and keep on going. He was that sick of the endless bickering. He decided against it in the end, though. It ain't much of a scout who leaves his people behind.
"Why don't you shut your old dough?"
Tull Duru's rumbling voice.
"You want us south, and when we went south, all you did was moan about the mountains. Now we're out of the mountains, you grumble on your empty belly all day and all night. I've had my fill of it, you whining dog."
Now came Black Dow's nasty growl.
"Why should you get twice as much to eat just 'cause you're a great fat pig? You little bastard, I'll crush you like the worm you are. I'll cut your neck while you sleep, you great pile of meat. Then we'll all have plenty to eat. At least we'd all be rid of your fucking snoring. I know now why they named you Thunderhead, you rumbling sow."
"Shut your holes, the pair of you!"
Dogman heard Three Trees roaring, loud enough to wake the dead.
"I'm sick of it!"
He could see them now, the five of them. Tull Duru and Black Dow bristling up to one another, Three Trees in between them with his hands up, Fawley sat watching, just looking sad, and Grim, not even watching, checking his shafts.
"Oi!"
hissed Dogman, and they all snapped round to look at him.
"It's the Dogman," said Grim, barely looking up from his arrows.
There was no understanding that man. He spoke nothing at all for days on end, then when he did speak, it was to say what they could all see already. Fawley was keen to distract the lads, as always. It was a hard guess how long they'd keep from killing each other without him around.
"What did you find, Dogman?"
he asked.
"What do you know? I found five stupid fucking bastards out in the woods,"
he hissed, stepping out from the trees.
"I could hear them from a mile away, and they were named men, these, would you believe? Men who should have known better, fighting among themselves, as always. Five stupid bastards!"
Three Trees raised his hand.
"All right, Dogman, we should know better."
And he glowered at Tull and Dow. They glowered at each other, but they said nothing more.
"What did you find?"
"There's fighting going on hereabouts, or something like it. I seen a farm burning." "Burning, say you?"
asked Tull.
"Aye."
Three Trees frowned.
"Take us to it, then."
The Dogman hadn't seen this from up in the trees, couldn't have. Too smoky and too far to see this. He saw it now, though, right up close, and it made him sick. They all saw it.
"This is some dark work here, all right,"
said Fawley, looking up at the tree.
"Some dark work."
"Aye,"
mumbled Dogman. He couldn't think of aught else to say. The branch creaked as the old man swung slowly round, his bare feet dangling near the earth. Might have been he tried to fight. He'd got two arrows through him. The woman was too young to be his wife, his daughter, maybe. The Dogman guessed the two young ones were her children.
"Who'd hang a child?"
he muttered.
"I can think of some black enough,"
said Tull. Dow spat on the grass.
"Meaning me?"
he growled, and the two of them were off again like hammer on anvil.
"I burned some farms and a village or two and all, but there were reasons. That was war. I let the children live."
"I heard different,"
said Tull. Dogman closed his eyes and sighed.
"You think I give a dog's arse for what you heard?"
Dow barked.
"Might be my name's blacker than I deserve, you giant shit!"
"I know what you deserve, you bastard!"
"Enough!"
growled Three Trees, frowning up at the tree.
"Have you no respect?"
"The Dogman's right. We're out of the mountains now and there's trouble brewing. There'll be no more of this squabbling. No more.
Quiet and cold from now on, like the winter time. We're named men, with men's work to do."
Dogman nodded, happy to hear some sense at last.
"There's fighting nearby," he said. "There has to be."
"Huh?"
said Grim, though it was hard to say exactly what he was agreeing with. Three Trees' eye was still fixed on the swinging bodies.
"You're right. We need to put our minds on that now. On that and nothing else. We'll track the crowd as did this and see what they're fighting for. We'll do no good until we know who's fighting who. Whoever did this
fights for Bethod, said Dow. You can tell just by the look in. We'll see. Tull and Dow, cut these folks down and bury 'em. Maybe that task'll put some steel back in you.
The two of them scowled at each other, but Three Trees paid 'em no mind.
Dogman, you'll go and sniff out those as did this. Sniff 'em out, and we'll pay 'em a visit tonight. A visit like they paid to these folks here.
Aye, said Dogman, keen to get on and do it. We'll pay 'em a visit.
The Dogman couldn't work it out. If they were in a fight, these lot, afraid of being caught out by an enemy, they weren't making too much of an effort to cover their tracks. He followed them, simple as could be. 5 of them, he reckoned. Must have strolled nice and easy away from the burning farm, down through the valley beside the river, and off into the woods. The tracks were so clear he got a little worried time to time, thinking they must be playing some trick on him, watching out there in the trees, waiting to hang him from a branch. Seemed they weren't, though, 'cause he caught up to them just before nightfall. First of all, he smelled their meat, mutton roasting. Next he heard their voices, talking, shouting, laughing, making not the meanest attempt to stay quiet, easy to hear even with the river bubbling beside. Then he saw them, sitting round a great big fire in a clearing, a sheep's carcass skinned on a spit above it, taken from those farmers, no doubt. The Dogman crouched down in the bushes, nice and still, like they should have been. He counted 5 men, or 4 and a boy about 14 years. They were all just sitting, no one standing guard, no caution at all. He couldn't work it out.
They're just sitting there, he whispered when he got back to the others. Just sitting, no guard, no nothing.
Just sitting? Asked Fawley.
Aye, 5 of 'em, sitting and laughing. I don't like it.
I don't like it neither, said Three Trees. But I like what I saw at that farm still less.
Weapons, hissed Dow. Weapons it has to be.
For once, Tull agreed with him.
Weapons, chief. Let's give 'em a lesson.
Not even Fawley spoke up for staying out of a fight this time. But Three Trees thought it out for a bit still, taking his moment, not to be hurried. Then he nodded.
Weapons it is.
You won't see Black Dow in the dark, not if he don't want to be seen. You won't hear him, neither. But the Dogman knew he was there as he crept down through the trees. You fight with a man for long enough, you get an understanding. You learn how he thinks, and you come to think the same way. Dow was there. The Dogman had his task. He could see the outline of the one on the far right, his back a black shape against the fire. Dogman didn't spare too much thought for the others yet. He spared no thought for anything but his task. Once you choose to go, or your chief chooses for you, you go all the way and never look back till the task's done. The time you spend thinking is the time you'll get killed in. Logan taught him that, and he'd taken it right to heart. That's the way it has to be. Dogman crept closer and closer still, feeling the warmth of the fire on his face, feeling the hard metal of the knife in his hand. By the dead, he needed to piss, as always. The task wasn't but a stride away now. The boy was facing him. If he'd have looked up fast from his meat, he'd have seen the Dogman coming, but he was too busy eating. Shouted one of the others. That meant Dowd got to him, and that meant he was finished. Dogman leapt forward and stabbed his task in the side of the neck. He reared up for a moment, clutching at his cut throat, took a stumble forward, and fell over. One of the others jumped up, dropping his half-chewed leg of mutton on the ground, then an arrow stuck him through the chest. Grim, out by the river. He looked surprised a minute, then he sank down on his knees, face twisted up with pain. That left but 2, and the boy was still sitting there, staring at the Dogman, mouth half open, with a bit of meat hanging out of it. The last of them was stood up, breathing quick, with a long knife in his hand. He must have had it out for eating with.
"Drop the blade!" bellowed Three Trees.
The Dogman saw the old boy now, striding towards them, the firelight catching the metal rim of his big round shield. The man chewed on his lip, eyes flicking from Dogman to Dow as they moved slowly to either side of him. Now he saw the Thunderhead looming out of the darkness in the trees, seeming too big to be a man, his great huge sword glinting over his shoulder. That was enough for him. He threw his knife down in the dirt. Dow jumped forward, grabbed his wrists and tied them tight behind him, then shoved him down on his knees beside the fire. The Dogman did the same with the boy, his teeth clenched tight, not saying a word. The whole thing was done in an instant, quiet and cold, like Three Trees said. There was blood on Dogman's hands, but that was the work and couldn't be helped. The others were making their way over now. Grim came sloshing through the river, throwing his bow across his shoulder. He gave the one he shot a kick as he came past, but the body didn't move.
"Dead," said Grim.
Fawley was at the back, peering at the two prisoners. Dow was staring at the one he'd tied, staring at him hard.
"I know this one here," he said, sounding quite pleased about it too. "Grower the Mire, ain't it? What a chance! You've been gnawing at the back of my mind for some time."
The Mire scowled down at the ground. A cruel-looking sort, the Dogman thought. The type that might hang farmers, if there was one.
"Oi, I'm the Mire. No need to ask your names. When they find you've killed some of the king's collectors, you'll be dead men all."
"Black Dow, they call me."
The Mire's head came up, his mouth wide open.
"Oh, fuck," he whispered.
The boy kneeling next to him stared round with big eyes.
"Black Dow? You what? Not the same Black Dow as... Oh, fuck."
Dow nodded slowly, with that nasty smile spreading across his face, that killing smile.
"Grower the Mire, you've all kinds of work to pay for. I've had you in my mind, and now you're in my eye."
He patted him on the cheek.
"And in my hand, too. What a happy chance."
The Mire snatched his face away as far as he could, trussed up like he was.
"I thought you were in hell, Black Dow, you bastard."
"So did I, but I was only north of the mountains. We've questions for you, Mire, before you get what's due. Who's this king? What is it you're collecting for him?"
"Fuck your questions."
Three Trees hit him on the side of his head, hard, where he couldn't see it coming. When he turned round to look, Dow cracked him on the other side. Back and forth his head went till he was soft enough to talk.
"What's the fight?"
asked Three Trees.
"We ain't fighting,"
spat the Mire through his broken teeth.
"You might as well be dead, you bastards. You don't know what's happened, do you?"
Dogman frowned. He didn't like the sound of this. Sounded like things had changed while they were gone, and he'd never yet seen a change for the better.
"I'll do the questions here," said Three Trees. "You just keep your tiny mind on the answers to 'em. Who's still fighting? Who won't kneel to Bethod?"
The Mire laughed, even tied up like he was.
"There's no one left. The fighting's over. Bethod's king now. King of all the North. Everyone kneels to him."
"Not us," rumbled Tal Duru, leaning down. "What about old man Yarl?"
"Dead."
"What about Scything or Rattleneck?"
"Dead and dead, you stupid fox. The only fighting now's down south. Bethod's gone to war with the Union. Aye, and we're giving him a beating too."
The Dogman wasn't sure whether to believe it.
King? There'd never been a king in the North before. There'd never been a need for one. And Bethod was the last one he'd have chosen. And making war on the Union? That was a fool's errand, surely. There were always more Southerners.
"If there's no fighting here," asked the Dogman, "what you killing for?"
"Fuck yourself."
Tull slapped him in the face hard, and he fell on his back. Dow put in a kick of his own, then dragged him up straight again.
"What did you kill him for?" asked Tull.
"Taxes!"
shouted the Mire, with blood trickling out of his nose.
"Taxes?" asked the Dogman.
A strange word, all right. He barely knew the meaning of it.
"I wouldn't pay."
"Taxes for who?" asked Dow.
"For Bethod. What do you think? He took all this land, broke the clans up and took it for his own. The people owe him, and we collect."
taxes, eh? That's a fucking southern fashion and no mistake.
And if they can't pay? Asked Dogman, feeling sick to his guts. You hang 'em, do you?
If they won't pay.